Welcome to WCG Talks Trials, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of clinical research, sharing the latest trends, insights, and best practices from experts across the industry. In each episode of WCG Talks Trials, we'll explore a different area of the clinical trial industry while featuring a diverse range of clinical research and medical professionals. If you're passionate about advancing clinical research, improving patient outcomes, and driving healthcare forward, then WCG Talks Trials is the right podcast for you. We are so glad you could join us today.
Hi, everyone. I'm Dr. Scott Hunter. I am the Senior Scientific Expert for Neurodevelopmental and Rare Pediatric Diseases here at WCG. And I'm thrilled to be your host for today's episode on the topic of addressing the need for racial, gender, sexual orientation, ethnicity, disability status, and socioeconomic diversity within clinical trials research. Before we dive in, let me remind you to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on your favorite listening platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify so you never miss an episode of WCG Talks Trials. I'm very excited to have with me today two exciting guests from across the industry. Dr. Sonia Dodizulu from the University of Chicago, where she is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience and a clinical child psychologist who specializes in understanding trauma and its impact and its treatment. And Desiree Underwood-Williams, who is a director of project management here with WCG. Thank you all so much for joining us. As I mentioned, we are focusing on the topic of diversity within clinical trials research specifically, but also wanting to address how to understand and ideally emphasize more directly consideration of intersectionality and how that can assist us with broadening our efforts with including diverse groups and individuals in our work, looking at the design and the effectiveness of treatments for diseases and conditions. With our esteemed individuals today, and before we get started, I'm going to ask for our guests to introduce themselves a little more fully than I've done, and ask them to tell us how and why did you come to join the clinical research industry or the related work that you do to it. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Dodizulu, please.
Hi, thank you, Dr. Hunter, for inviting me to be a part of this discussion. So the work that I do, again, is, as you noted, I work with youth and families exposed to trauma and violence, and I specialize in assessment, diagnosing, and treatment. And how did I come to this work? It's been a process in the making. I have lived in Chicago and worked in Chicago for most of my adult life. And the one thing about Chicago that I've learned that's really different from New York is that the city is extremely segregated, and it's really, really hard to do the clinical work that I do and the clinical research that I do without considering multifaceted aspects of individuals that live here in Chicago, particularly Black and brown families that I serve. Community violence and other forms of violence happens nationwide. However, the thing about Chicago is that the structural systems and inequities that put in place are factors that we have to consider in the work that we do. And that's where the diversity, equity, and inclusion is so critical to pay attention. And anyone who does clinical and research efforts in the city of Chicago and beyond really needs to consider the multifaceted aspects and how even, for example, trauma and violence became to be such a very distinct experience for certain identities. And when I say certain identities in the work that I do, it's Black and brown individuals from disinvested neighborhoods that deals with a lot of structural inequities and structural violence. So those are the factors that I heavily consider when I work with youth and families exposed to trauma. It's not just the criterion A, DSM-5 definition. It is that within the larger context that really that DE&I efforts need to pay attention to.
Thank you for sharing that, because I think that it actually is a very key consideration that we'll be paying attention to as we're talking today, given our desire to bring in to clinical trials and to engage individuals who bring these histories and experiences with them, and also to understand what keeps them from actually wanting to be a part of the work that is so necessary to assist in providing greater opportunities for effective outcomes and interventions that will allow for a much more productive and successful life ahead. And Desiree, if you'll introduce yourself a bit more too, please. Thank you.
Sure. And thank you for the invite on the podcast. I'm very excited to be here. My name is Desiree Underwood-Williams. I am the Director of Project Management at WCG. My primary responsibilities within the organization are to work with business leaders to create the guidelines, standards, and training and development of our project management organization. So for context, that really means that I'm working with the PMs, who are essentially the point person for clinical trial facilitation at WCG. And how did I get into the industry? So it has been a very interesting path for me. I started off interning in clinical research, and I knew right away that I wanted to continue down this path. However, it wasn't a straight line. I started to work at the United Nations, according to the vice chair of UN Economic and Social Council. And I was working on initiatives related to primary education for all, improving maternal health, environmental sustainability. And then I found myself at the point where I was like, okay, what do I really want to focus on? There was so much happening, and I felt like I could make a bigger impact if I really just honed in one area. So I went down the clinical research path, and I started to work at clinical research sites. And then I moved into more of corporate positions where I felt like I can have a bigger impact.
Oh, sounds wonderful. So I think what's exciting to me here is having both of you available to kind of address some of these very key issues that I think are ones that, from my own discussions with sponsors, with CROs, with my fellow researchers, because I too come into this industry having spent many years as a professor and as a principal and co-investigator on research, where the challenge was always making sure that the information that we were seeking to gain was representative of the communities in which we situate and exist in, and finding that that was always very difficult. And so I think that that's where I really want to be thinking today with both of you, is how we actually can help provide some information that's going to guide those who are listening, who are looking to actually improve opportunity outcome, but also engagement. So a question I want to pose to each of you first, foremost, is why is diversity so key when we're thinking about how to best ensure that we understand the range of kind of mechanisms and outcomes that are involved in clinical care and response?
So when I think about that, I just feel like diversity is so essential in clinical care and response because it should reflect the real world population, especially in clinical research, where we're ultimately trying to benefit the population that has the particular ailment or disease that we're going to treat. So a diverse participant pool ensures that researchers capture the full spectrum of genetic, biological, psychological, or socio-cultural factors that influence health and treatment outcomes. And I think sometimes we can kind of put ourselves in a silo. We don't look at all the differences that make up the population we're trying to treat, but it's critical in order for us to ensure that we don't increase health disparities, that we look at a more diverse population.
Exactly. Dr. Kizulu, how would you like to add?
Yeah, so I agree with Desiree has shared already. I think it's also important that, you know, without considering diversity, we'll often have misalignments or malalignments of perceptions. And if we don't consider that, then we're missing a whole body of being able to provide effective clinical care. And clinical care ranges from, you know, from the therapeutics, the bench science, all the way through like actually patient face-to-face care.
I'm curious about your thoughts on how we make better sense of intersectionality when we're talking about diversity, so that we actually help the teams that are doing research and who are working to create the studies. I'm thinking about, given specifically now the FDA requires that we include the range of members of community into our studies, how we can best do that so that we're looking to meet people with who they are.
Yeah, that's a good point, Scott, that you raised. So intersectionality, let's bring forth a Black history back. So Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who is in the field of law, and she's been the thought leader, the person who's really pushed this conceptualization around, and the person actually who coined the term intersectionality. And she discovered in her work about the different identities of Black women and how they compared to white counterparts and how Black women suffered more in terms of their race and their gender and among other components where the penalties that they may experience may be very different. So meaning more harsh or complex compared to white counterparts. So when we think about it more broadly, you know, we're looking at how intersectionality is really about the complex, cumulative way where multiple forms of discrimination can combine, overlap, intersect, or, you know, just really have us examine the experiences of people of multiple marginalized identities. If they're not part of the dominant group, instead they're in the target group, then we have to consider the different facets. So intersectionality allows us to have a lens that we can see in different ways of how discrimination and oppression, especially if it's systematic oppression, how it exists, how does it compound the multiple identities and dimensions, and that when we are able to look at the multiple identities within the actual context, as Desiree had said earlier, like real world situations versus just taking one aspect of it and isolating it from the larger context, then we get to see how more complex it is because, you know, the sum of its parts are going to be not as, you know, the individual parts are going to be way more greater when you add it all together. So you can see all the complexity. So if we don't consider intersectionality, we'll be less inclusive, we'll have way more blind spots, and we will not be accepting of all identities and understanding the experiences of that person.
I agree. And I think what stood out to me that you said, Dr. Sonia, is that the experiences of individuals, I think, you know, if we're just realistic, we all have different experiences, and sometimes we have to bring those forth. And when you mentioned the mandate now, right, that pharma companies need to facilitate their trials in a certain way to be inclusive, I think that one of the ways we can really have an impact in this area is to start diversifying from leadership. And I say this often, but who is at the table creating this protocol? Who's reading it? Who's vetting it? Are those individuals consulting with different ethnic groups or different individuals from different socioeconomic backgrounds, whatever those communities that will be affected are? Who are we consulting with? Who's sitting at the table? If we look around and we do not see that someone is sitting at the table who is represented in this protocol, in this research study, in this trial, whatever we're doing, then we should question whether or not we have the correct approach. Because we cannot do this in a silo. We cannot, because there are different experiences that we should consider. And we'll never always get it right every single time, but we should be putting forth the effort, right? We should be able to say we tried. We should look back and say, maybe we can do it better next time. And so I think we just need to start to be realistic and look through the lens. What lens are we looking through to establish these protocols or the care that we're giving our patients? So I think that we just have to be realistic and intentional.
I agree completely. And I think what you're both hitting on, which is really something that has stood out to me, you know, one of the things that I do as part of my work with WCG is to actually help from the front end whenever possible through vetting the protocol and the approaches that are being taken and recognizing in particular that how the endpoints are designed and made sense of in the protocol and then in the ways that it's going to be presented to the research teams to support them in being able to bring in the best groups of people that they can as participants, that it really is the case that we need to be talking very early on about, can we actually address what is going to be that wealth of potential difference that different members of communities are going to bring in. You know, I'm always struck by the fact that as I have become certainly more thoughtful and educated in my own considerations for inclusive work, is that it is not just one factor that we're looking as that checkbox, that it ultimately is the case that each of the individuals who comes in brings with them a wealth of personal elements of who they are, and that that's also represented within their biology and their psychology and their sociocultural considerations. And it certainly is something that plays out, I think, in how we engage researchers and sponsors to be thinking about who it is that needs to be included, but also, you know, wanting to hear from you now, ways in which you think that we can more directly assist them in paying attention to this question so that we can actually allow for there to be this breadth of consideration of what is diversity and how does that then become included within the study itself?
Yeah, I think so. I'm just thinking about this really important question, ways to engage. And I think it's very multifaceted. I think it's at the individual level, some things that researchers have to start grappling with and taking accountability for. And then at the policy systems level, that there are certain either incentives or, you know, accountability standards that are put in place to make sure that diversity and inclusion is actually moving forward in the direction towards better outcomes for all identities that are involved. So at the individual level, I'm thinking, you know, one of the ways that could be challenged for researchers is if they come from a very old school, you know, graduate program, medical program or both, where, you know, inclusivity and diversity was not part of their training, like reporting even the data in very sensitive ways, like they leave out those demographics of those socially constructed identities that we're talking about, right? And so that doesn't really help, you know, promote the idea of inclusivity. So I think, and I'm just going to say this unequivocally, but in order to promote DEI, you really do have to be anti-racist. You have to be anti-racist. You have to use some of those approaches, the ideology, the philosophy, whatever you may want to call it, but you have to be on the offense rather than being passive. So what does anti-racist look like in clinical care? Desiree, you already mentioned it, like making sure you have people who represent the population you're trying to study are in those decision-making seats, right? They're in the room. Who's in the room with you? If you don't have anyone who looks like you, it's really important. So having those important individuals are there, you know, so increasing representation of marginalized and minoritized individuals in health research. So mental health doesn't matter. We need to have those individuals. And how do we increase that representation? That's a whole nother story, but we know historically distrust has been a part of the problem. We have to eliminate discriminatory practices of marginalized participants involved in research. So the incentives could look different for certain populations. How to engage people in research could look different, you know, for certain populations. And so we need to really make sure that the way that we recruit, the way that we may provide participant payments from, you know, well, really recruitment is the big piece of it. And being able to retain people to stay within research is something that we as, you know, we cannot do alone as an industry. We really need the partnering of the people that we're trying to study to be a part of these processes. Making sure we have people who are hired to match the demographic that we're trying to study, right? So making sure that people who are recruiting for research look like the individuals, or not so much to look like, but have shared similar identities or exact identities as the people that we're trying to address the population that we're trying to study. Financial access to barriers, making sure that, you know, for the studies that we do, we make sure that our participants are getting free transportation at times, because we work with a lot of families, so food insecure, making sure that if we're catching them at dinner time or any time of meals, that we provide those kinds of resources, social determinants of health that can get in the way of people participating. So those are just a few ideas of what does it mean to be anti-racist? You know, if you're not being anti-racist, right, then being passive or silent about it means that you can still collude with racism.
That was good. I can just echo everything that was just said, to be honest with you. My experience at clinical research sites, when it comes to those barriers, right? Like, how do we remove the barriers? We should always be thinking of how do we remove barriers so that we can address the population that we are trying to target for this clinical trial. And so I think removing some of those barriers, we think about things such as transportation or even childcare. And we're thinking, and it's, you know, we're at an intersectionality as we're saying, right? We can have someone who is disabled, but someone who also is having issues in their finances. Like, these are different things we need to look at across individuals who are participating to see that, to ask ourselves, what can we do to make entering this trial easier for the population that needs access to this investigational drug? And I think, Dr. Sonia, you hit on another point about accurate and comprehensive data. Like, we need data transparency. We need data collection. I think in the age of AI, we have access to more data than we did in the past. And just coming across the data and kind of leveraging it to identify and address disparities, finding out, you know, what populations would need in order to remove the barriers, right? And another thing I think is just raising awareness. I think awareness is big because there are social biases and unconscious biases that different communities may have towards others. So we have to constantly be in training mode and in community engagement mode where we're saying, okay, are we addressing those barriers in education, those barriers in awareness and training that our staff may even have when it comes to facilitating an equitable clinical trial?
I think you have both hit on what are some of the most key considerations. You know, one of the things that was exciting to me at a recent conference that I attended was actually a kind of subgroup meeting that allowed for really discussing in depth, what is it that sponsors and CROs and individual CRAs and project managers and, you know, the members of the team who are involved in supporting the trial, what is it they need to know in terms of how they can actually engage with the communities that they're seeking to bring into these studies, and recognizing that it means going into those communities and preparing to enter these communities, and then preparing to be able to sit and listen to what the community and the members of that community actually, in thinking about themselves and all of the components that define who they are intersectionally, what that will contribute to the study, but what is it that the supports are that are going to be required to do that? You know, as I think about from what you were just saying, what strategies would you say you've seen that are being utilized? Would you like to kind of push forward and to help our audience today really be thinking a little bit more about what's been effective and what they can be prepared to take advantage of?
So one of the positions I hold here at WCG, in addition to my actual functional job, is advisor to the Black Woman of WCG, which is an employee resource group that we have here. And so we've had this discussion internally quite a bit, especially during COVID-19 and everything that came along with that change, that pandemic. And we were discussing some of what we thought were the top ways to engage the minority community in particular. And so we were saying, well, what about the churches? Go into the community and engage at the churches, you know, that those, the matriarchs and of the family, and those individuals are really big in the Black community. So I think we have to really think about outreach and where individuals find community and find trust, and partner with those organizations that represent community and trust for the population you're trying to reach, because we want that from that population. We want them to trust us, and we want them to see us as an extension of their community, as being there to help, not to, you know, just be kind of an annoying, yeah, join our trial. No, like, we're really trying to put out a drug that supports everyone and everybody who is affected. And you want them to understand that.
Desiree, you raise one of the strategies that I value most in my own research, and not even in research, is clinical care broadly defined, which is including, you know, direct service as well as research, is building that trust. Because I'm a mental health provider, so mental health stigma, healthcare distrust, and things of that nature definitely plays a role, but it's still playing a role in research as well. So I'm putting my feet in both of those aspects to make sure that we're in communities as best as possible. We have an extension of people who work with us to be in those communities. And we have these partnerships and relationships so that we're not just coming into pillage, take data, and then leave. Like, we're trying to build sustainable relationships where people feel that they are invested and that we truly do care. And that trust matters immensely because we cannot do this work. So, you know, so I wholeheartedly value making sure that those relationships extend itself. And I definitely push for researchers, whether it's in the corporate industry and as well as the healthcare industry, that those relationships don't start when you're thinking about a grant, you know, or additional funding or a clinical trial. Those relationships start way beforehand. Like, what relationships does WCG have with community partners outside of getting funding, right? What relationships does the University of Chicago have? Which I know what these relationships are, but I, you know, there's still some barriers. And I love how you said earlier, Desiree, what are the barriers that we can break down, right? Why is it that we still have underrepresentation? Why is it hard, you know, for us to sometimes reach the people that we're trying to reach, you know? So what are those barriers, being able to identify that? And one of those barriers could still be the lack of trust. And it could be convenience out of sampling a population, right? We're, you know, we got funding, we're going to be around for a few years, and then we go. That is not the message that the people need to hear. So I cannot underscore and emphasize that enough. And that, to me, again, is very much of a anti-racist approach. And again, what to say earlier, anti-racism is not just about race. It includes all the isms. And when we think about strategies where people have been minoritized or marginalized, they're very similar. They may be delivered in different ways because you have to be specific to certain identities or populations. However, the thought around it is still very much similar. So I think I have a few more things, if I may add to this conversation about, you know, what are some of the additional things that stakeholders, you know, that the industry could do to help, you know, increase representation and inclusivity. And I think we've said this already, but we need to have key stakeholders. I know we said we have community participants, but I need to give them an official name, an official title, even hire them and pay them to be key stakeholders, you know, to be in the long-term commitment. We cannot think about it as, again, as the convenient sampling. We need to have investment in stakeholders, however they may look like, but we need to have that investment. So I think naming them as stakeholders and significant collaborators is really important. Being the term, you know, being this for the long run, it's not going to be overnight. Like, you have to build these relationships, right? And then patient engagement, I think we've mentioned that a little bit, but I'm just wanting to name it. You know, we need to have those diverse patient populations to be a part of, you know, from recruitment to reviewing literacy, you know, to documentation, communication methods, you know, is it culturally sensitive, relevant, you know, in terms of matching identities? They will be able to tell us all of those things. So I think having, we say in the field of psychology, community-based participatory research, basically we have partnerships with key stakeholders within a community. Make a long story short, they are part of every stage of the process of the research that we do, from the beginning to identifying the problem to being able to think about dissemination, data collection, everything. So it's a long haul type of thing. It's not something where we can just do overnight.
Hands down. I think both of you are hitting on something that has increasingly become understood, but I think is without a doubt still important to be reviewed repeatedly. I mean, I was just at National Organization for Rare Disease meeting virtually. And, you know, one of the things that's taking place in the rare disease community is really the engagement now with the patient advocacy groups, with the researchers being now in dialogue constantly, and the developers of the drugs being involved constantly from start to finish with these individuals, the caregivers of and the patients themselves who experience these challenges, and also understanding who they are and where they come from as a way of then making sure that the treatments that are being thought about are ones that can really have an impact on the full understanding of who they are and how they can actually be successful moving forward and what possibilities exist for them. And this is something that, from what you're saying, we're really, I think, hitting home, which is that you need to be paying attention from the get-go about the potential biases that might hold you back from being able to successfully develop the study in a way that's going to bring in the individuals who need this as a potential outcome. But at the same time, the biases that we hold about how we come to engage with these communities. You know, with that, I want to see if we can kind of end here, since we're certainly coming towards the end of time that we have available. But where do you see a need for greater improvement around engaging communities and mitigating the biases that hold them back? I think that that will actually be a nice place for us to then move our audience forward in their efforts.
I think that we can never see our work as done. We can never feel like we are complete. We always have to, you know, look at the landscape of what we're doing and say, okay, what's next? What do we need to do next? I think, you know, we talked about a lot of great options to move forward today. And I think what stood out to me are those relationships that were discussed, developing those relationships and really treating people like people. Everyone is people. That's someone's mother, someone's father, someone's child, and really listening to them and their needs as well. I think engaging with primary care physicians who may have a longer, long-lasting relationship with their, you know, patients is also a good approach. And gaining confidence and, you know, trust with them. Trust is, it's this book called The Speed of Trust. And although it relates to business, I think trust is just something we can't overlook here. When you have trust, everything moves quicker. We get to the end quicker. Yeah. So, you know, we cannot move forward without trust. But also what we have to gain as an industry with trust is clinical trial retention, better data. You know, we want people to not just start a trial, but finish a trial. So how do we do that? Through relationship building, through trust. We don't want to be in and out. We want those long-term relationships. So I think we have a lot of work to do, but we started. We're moving, and we could just never see our work as being done. We have to keep going.
That's right. I don't know if I can add anything more to what you said, because we've been talking about that, this theme of trust throughout. As someone who is a trauma expert, not to say that everybody who's been minoritized or marginalized experienced trauma, but I think they have, you know, just it's a degree. It's just a degree, because the isms are stressful and they're harmful. But one of the ways to recover from harm is building trust. And the way you could do that is through connection. We're humans. We thrive on social connections. And it's not through social media that we say, hey, we're recruiting. That's later down the road. It's really those, you know, from the ground up, we really have to prioritize, emphasize building these relationships, understanding the socio, political, historical context of every group that needs to be included in the work that we do. And the reason why they haven't been included because of discriminatory practices that causes harm, right? So that causes harm. So if we're thinking about it that way, there's repair and trust that goes across all of the identities, no matter what. Not just about race, right? It's not about gender or sex. It's across all identities, including ableism. And just so you know, we're temporarily able-bodied folks. So if we ever become disabled mentally or physically, you know, we want to make sure that those relationships are put in place, you know, so that if we're ever studied or participate in a research study, that we know that we can trust the people who are doing that. So I think that's foundational. I don't know if you know this, that NIH just released a statement that in January 2025, now they're going to look at inclusion criteria for any human subjects. Now they're subject to scoring. Before it wasn't. Now it's subject to scoring. I don't know how much score you're going to get. But factors like inclusion of women, minorities, people of all ages are now, you're going to be scored on that, which is holding people accountable. So I bring this up. Because the gold standard getting NIH funding is now even trying to hold people accountable to making sure that inclusive practices are going to be put in place. So I think, you know, there's so many ways, but I think, you know, Desiree, I think if people have to walk away with something, you know, from that question that you're asking, Scott, there's so much more to say, but I really think foundational, you need to have that trust. Because if we're talking about D&I, we're talking about trying to address the minoritized or marginalized individuals. And that causes harm when we don't study, of course. But, you know, in order to repair that harm, we have to have trust so we can have better relationships.
Hands down, hands down. I can't argue enough about that being the key piece. And I want to add to, you know, what NIH is pushing forward for grant-funded research is already being heard loud and clear as well in the clinical trials industry with regard to pharma as well and other areas of treatment, in fact. And I think that in order to ensure that we are able to move our understanding of how to best address disease forward, we have to be able to address all communities who are impacted by disease and who need treatment and support. And we won't be able to do that effectively if we don't have those individuals in the studies. And everything that we've talked about today, I really do believe is key for allowing us to do so effectively. I want to thank you both, Desiree Underwood Williams, Dr. Sonia Denizulu. It's been fantastic to have you talk on this episode of WCG Talks Trials. I want to also thank our listeners for tuning in. We hope that you found this episode insightful, and we hope that you'll join us next time on future episodes.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of WCG Talks Trials. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on your preferred listening platform as we continue to explore different areas of the clinical research industry. As always, we encourage you to join in the conversation. Feel free to reach out to us if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions for future topics you'd like to hear on the show by visiting us at wcgclinical.com/podcast. We're here to serve as a trusted resource as we work to improve lives and accelerate clinical research together.